Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Now, Ronnie Moran, as we've seen in the tributes pouring in since his death was announced, is clearly a huge figure in Liverpool's history, both as former captain and a long-standing coach who worked under all of the great Liverpool managers and was there for all their brilliant successes. I'm delighted to say we've got Graeme Souness with us. He both played under him as a coach and, of course, worked with him when he returned as manager. Graeme, before we talk about Ronnie and your time there as manager, one of the pictures that's definitely emerging today from players who worked under him is that of a harsh taskmaster, someone who never let anybody at the club get ahead of themselves. And in many ways, it's a very important role for people to play, but this picture of Ronnie Moran that's out there is of someone who was very tough, very old school.
Well, yeah, you've described him. I think one of his jobs is making sure that everybody was bang at it, everyone kept their feet on the ground, and it didn't matter if you're a young guy just joining the club or what he used to call us, the big heads, you know, the established players at the club. We were the big heads, and he got after us at every opportunity. Every football club should have one. I'm not sure if he could operate today. They wouldn't accept him today because he didn't mix his words. He told you exactly how it was. And at that time in football, if you were real, you know, you responded to his way of work. I really find it hard to find the right words to talk about, because maybe in death he'll be given greatness, but he should have been given it while he was alive. I mean, for all the success that Liverpool had, you know, starting in the 60s, 70s, 80s, but the 90s, you know, he was instrumental. He was as instrumental as anyone. You know, there's people like, you know, you talk about Shankly and Paisley, but Joe Fagan, Ronnie Moran, Peter Robinson, who was the chief executive secretary, these were all the truly, truly key men at the football club, and they had as big a part to play in their success as anyone you want to name, including Shankly and Paisley. Ronnie's up there, and he should be up there in the same breath, because he was the one that we worked with every day. He, you know, Joe was there just sort of looking over things. Bob was there overseeing things. But Ronnie was the one that did most of the talking, did all the coaching, and at the same time got us bang at it. You know, he wasn't slow in falling out with us if he felt it was the right thing to do. And he managed the training in his way. And that, it worked big time.
That's pretty interesting, because, you know, part of the stuff coming across today, there's a bunch of different things. Like Jamie Carragher says he's the first person who ever really taught him how to be a central defender instead of just a fullback, and that's interesting as well, because obviously that's a tricky enough transition for anybody to make, as well as Carragher does it. But it's interesting to hear you say that, because part of the other picture is just somebody who's just shouting at everybody the whole time, and that might, from listening to you, just be a bit too cartoonish. Yeah.
No, that's exactly what he was. He got after you when he just saw, if there was the slightest drop in standards, he made a mountain out of it. He was looking for a reason to keep us on our toes, and it worked. You know, he wasn't arm around the shoulder saying, "Come on, you know you can do better." It was harsh. You know, it was in your face. He wasn't asking for us to be better. He sort of demanded it, and he cut no one any slack. Whether you're a big established player or when you're one of the kids, you're treated the same. And he got the response. You know, Joe was a different animal. You know, Joe was quietly spoken, didn't say as much. And they were the two that we spent most of the time with. The manager, when I first went there, Bob Paisley, was in the background. And he obviously made the big important decisions. But on the day-to-day stuff, Joe and Ronnie ran the training. They would obviously decide before they got on the training ground what they were going to do. And Joe would make the calls there. But when we got actually on the grass, it was all about Ronnie.
So Ronnie's implementing game plans, like down to telling you how the team is actually going. I mean, you played fairly similar, I guess, week in, week out, because you were the best team in the land, and so you were the ones who were imposing your game plan. But certainly in terms of like the structure of how the team played, his input was very important.
Yeah, well, you hit it. We never tried to play any different from one week to the other, from year to year. It was kept as simple and as basic as possible for everyone to understand. There was no master plan when we played Man United or Bayern Munich. It was just more of the same. We were told we were better players. And as long as we matched the other team for effort, this might simplify it, but as long as we matched the other team for effort, we would win 9 times out of 10 because we are better players. And his job was to keep us grounded and get the message across in a simple, very straightforward way in training. As I said, he never needed to be asked twice to have a go at us if he felt any of us were slacking. He'd fall out with us. You know, he was prepared to do that. He would stop small-sided games if he felt people weren't at it. See, that's it. You've had your chance. They'd take us off doing hard running.
Did players ever resent him for it, Graham?
No, because if you're a player in those days, you know the pecking order. You know that he had been there, he'd done it all. You know, he'd been part of it from the very beginning, and you couldn't question him. There was no if he offered something up. Let me put it this way: I'm 30 years old. I'm captain of Liverpool. I'm captain of Scotland. I've won what I've won. I'm a big player. I'm a big head.
Yeah.
If in a team meeting he had said something, and I had offered a different opinion to his, which I wouldn't dare, he'd have been standing over me like a parent with a 5-year-old wanting to give me a clip round the ear. But no, I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have challenged what he said. Kenny wouldn't have challenged what he said. It just wasn't done because he had that authority. He had, I've been there, I've done it, don't question me. It really was that respected.
It seems like he also did have a sense of humour, which we shouldn't overlook. Like Kenny Dalglish is talking in a new book out about Ronnie Moran, and he said, you know, Joe Fagan and Ronnie Moran would often have a half a bottle of whiskey in the dugout, and you know, they'd say, well, look, we'll have a little nip when we score. And then if it got to a point and there were no goals coming, Ronnie would turn to Joe and say, Joe, why don't we just have a drink if we get a free kick in the next 10 minutes?
Yeah, I've been involved in games and I've seen them only when it's going well. You know, maybe we're two or three up with a couple of minutes to go, and you know, they'd be cheering us with a thimble full of it. You know, they were on the touchline. They did nearly everything right, and the results and what we won at that time would suggest that. They knew how to laugh. They knew how to enjoy themselves. Joe was so respectful of Ronnie. You know, Joe, even when he was, I don't know what age, he must have been well into his 50s, he would hang on every word that Joe would say. You know, out of respect for Joe.
Mm.
You know, Joe, I think he saw Joe as... I never asked him this, but I think he might have seen Joe as sort of the real brains, the one that's really worth listening to. Because Joe did speak in such a interesting manner. You had to listen in to speak to him because he spoke in such a slow voice. Bob Paisley obviously had his attributes, but he didn't speak a great deal. It was more Joe was with us day to day, and Joe and Ronnie, between the two of them, they were a proper double act. You know, many times I could see Ronnie, I could see it in my head now, turning away, shaking his head and saying, work it out for yourself, son. But if he said that to you, it was not good. Because that means he's thinking this boy might be beyond help. You know, if he said work it, you ask any Liverpool player at some time in the period at the club would have had that said to him, work it out for yourself, son.
It's interesting listening to you talk about Joe Fagan that way, and I wonder maybe if Fagan actually needed Ronnie Moran. Obviously he comes through and so he has that respect because he's got the job and he's been around for a long period of time. But, you know, in football, particularly, I guess, in that era, you couldn't be too softly spoken. You needed to be able to have a team around you who trusted you. And it helps if Ronnie Moran is your enforcer, making sure that all of you guys are automatically on board. I'm not saying that you wouldn't have been, but just that you can just to shore up that sense of, okay, he might be softly spoken, but as a team, this is strong words, softly spoken.
But see when people say good cop, bad cop, that's suggesting that it's premeditated. I'm going to go in and be the nice guy today, Ronnie, you be the bad guy. I never felt that. I think it was, you know, if something had to be said, Ronnie would see it. He would see it. You know, and Joe would, you know, I can't say never, but would never sort of interrupt Ronnie when he was in full flow. I mean, Ronnie, I mean, it was that time. We were men, and they treated us like men, and they expected us to react like men. They expected us to, you know, if you get a rollicking, don't go playing about it. Don't, you know, go sulking about it. They wanted a response. And you had to respond, because if you didn't, you weren't at Liverpool very long. Ronnie didn't need a second chance to dig you out. I mean, he really did. And between the two of them, they were nigh on perfect, as I've said, because they kept us on our toes. We were bang at it all the time, and the results and the achievements at that time would suggest they did pretty much everything right.
The amazing thing about Ronnie Moran is he's at the club for 49 years, and when Kenny took over as manager, he's quoted as saying, "I trusted Roy Evans and Ronnie Moran implicitly. They were totally honest, loyal men who'd never be stool pigeons in the dressing room. Ronnie and Roy watched us like hawks, scrutinising every move and word. I know modern day clubs use technology to chart performance and training, but I'd back the eyes of Ronnie and Roy ahead of anyone's computer." And you obviously made the decision to keep Ronnie and Roy with you as well when you came in as manager. Was there any tension there with the new ideas, diet, training that you were bringing in, and I presume Ronnie's love of a very old school way of doing things?
I can't say the button to everything on day one, but the longer we spoke about it, you know, you got to remember, they had won everything doing things a certain way. But my ideas were not radical. I wasn't trying to get us to play any differently. It was just about diet, about less alcohol, you know, coming but not changing at Anfield and going by bus down to Melwood, turning up at Melwood and that, using that as more of a base. And that all happened in time. You know, that was the way it was in the continent long before we did it. In this country, and there was no dramas involved. They bought into it because I think they saw the way the game was going, that they had so much success having fish and chips after a game, allowing the boys to have more than two or three bottles of lager on the bus on the way home. You know, things were changing, and that's what I tried to introduce. I wanted to change the way they played. I didn't want to change the training methods, because wherever I've been as a manager, all I've tried to do is emulate what I learned as a player at Liverpool.
Was it a difficult thing for you to go from where you were 30 years old and a big head and you wouldn't dream of questioning Ronnie Moran to then having to say, "Ronnie, you're wrong here, we need to evolve"?
No, it wasn't. I mean, I'd never say, "No, you're wrong."
Right.
I'd say, this is what I've learned, this is the way I'd like to do it. And he would be respectful and say, "Yeah, okay." I mean, they're all basic common sense things that I tried to introduce. But no, Ronnie's fine. Never ever any issues with Ronnie Moran when I went back as manager. You know, I lent on him heavily. He had all that knowledge that he had gleaned over the years working with the people he had worked with. Why would you use that? Why would you use that?
Did you give any thought to not having him as part of your backroom team at all? Because there's definitely that narrative out there that, I think even in that book that Joe was talking about, Ronnie's son is quoted as saying a rumour went out that maybe he wasn't going to be part of your team.
Well, was I there 2.5 years, and I think maybe in the last 6 months I spoke to him, so what about taking a step in another direction and being the overseer of everything? Again, football was changing dramatically. There was never a case that I never wanted him with me. I think you've said that wasn't something that at the forefront of my mind had just now. I think I asked him, and maybe in the last 6 months, why don't you become like in charge of all the coaches? You're looking at everything and telling everyone how they should be doing it. If anything, I was giving him maybe more responsibility. And when as I said, he was someone who had all that knowledge. At the time, he might have been at the club, I don't know, 30, 40 years at the time.
Like a director of football role, in a way, before it kind of...
Not a director of football, because that would suggest that would be everything he would have hated, and as much as, you know, sitting in board meetings, having to write reports. So this was just watching every coach, how they work, and dropping them his information in, and to benefit those lads as they were working right across the board, from the youths all the way to the first team.
Graeme, just a last point. You talked there about how Moran should be spoken about in the same breath as the really great people, the great men who've worked at Liverpool Football Club. Did he harbour ambitions to manage? Was that a regret of his, no, do you suspect?
I think that you would wake up one day, like we all did, and think, you know, why would I want to do that job? And then it'd be another day when you would think, yeah, I think I'd like to have a go at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's football management. But I don't think Ronnie would have enjoyed. Ronnie was very much at home on the training ground, and all the other things that go with being a manager, he would not particularly have enjoyed. I think he was at his happiest when he was with players on the training ground.
Kelly Cates tells a story about Ronnie Moran at the end of one season where you'd won the league, walking into the dressing room with a box full of league medals and plonking them on the table and going, if you deserve one, take one.
No, that wasn't a one-off. That wasn't a one-off. He would come in. I mean, I can remember when we'd win something, literally, you've got the trophy in your hands, you're back in the dressing room, and he would say to Joe would say it, or Ronnie would say it, but it was, you know, they obviously said this many, many times. Well, Joe, we've got a contract for another year then, you know, because we just maybe won the league or the European Cup. And they were sort of saying to us, well, look, that's how we're grounded. We think we'll just won another year. Hopefully we'll won another year. We just won the European Cup. And the story about coming in with a cardboard box is 100% correct. There is another bit to it where he'd come in and he'd walk around and say, okay, if you played it, he'd throw it on there was a massage table in the home dressing room. He would throw the box, not throw it, but drop the box on the table and say, well, if you played enough games and you think you deserve one, you can have one of them. And he'd walk out and we'd wait for him and he'd turn the corner in the home dressing room and he'd come back and he'd say, and by the way, we get F all this year for what's in that box, and walk away. It was, again, it was just before we kicked the ball in earnest.
I presume all that said, Souness is straight up and says, damn right I deserve a medal, no?
No, I wouldn't. I told you, I was frightened of him. Let me tell you another story. We had played an Eastern Europe, a Romanian team, and I'd got involved with one of their players. I'd end up doing something I shouldn't have done. I threw a punch at him. He had to go off. So at the end of the game, and remember, this is kind of Iron Curtain times. So at the end of the game at Anfield, you go off the pitch and then you start to climb a few stairs. And as I'm starting to come up the stairs, I can see the guy who's broke his jaw. He's got ice packed into a towel and he's got it tied around his head. And I'm obviously chuckling at him.
And
these two big guys in long leather coats appeared from nowhere. And they're making their way doors and he'd come up the stairs. And then again, from nowhere, Ronnie appears. Ronnie had a massive chest. He's a great, big, powerful man, Ronnie. And he sort of said to him, okay then, what are you going to do about it? And there was some sort of blue language thrown at them. And he thought twice about confronting me. So I was forever grateful for Ronnie not, you know, prevent me getting a backhand of that night, I think.
The only man in the world who could bounce for Graeme Souness.
No, he could. As I said, we were pretty frightened of Ronnie Moran. He wasn't a bully. Not, don't get me wrong, he wasn't a bully, but you know, he was, when he kicked off, he was quite ferocious.
Graeme, great stuff.
Yeah,
thanks.
He'd be sorely missed.
Thanks a million.
Brilliant, Graeme. Thanks.
Off the ball.
Home of live Premier League every Sunday from midday.
On News Talk 106 to 108.
All right, we had a massive response to that Mayo piece a little bit earlier on, but it was all basically saying, shut up, what are you talking about? Okay. What about our county? Blah, blah, blah.
Well,
it was kind of the subtlety that we were looking for.
I did feel we were using Mayo as emblematic of what lots of counties are having to do. That's the point, really.
Yeah, it's just that they've got so close. All the other counties who are going through it, with the exception of Donegal, I think are the only realistic. Because I think Cork have massive industrial centres and can easily sort out jobs for people
in
a way that Donegal can't.
Yeah, sure. And that's why we talked Mayo, but we didn't mean that Roscommon or Leitrim don't have the same issues.
Yeah, it's just that they're nowhere near an All-Ireland, yeah, is the thing. So it doesn't actually affect
them. But for the people moaning, saying, what about our counties?
What about our counties? What about our country? Is that where we're starting?
Yeah. So today's press conference was dull. But we'll bring it to the people.
See,
anyway.
All of these press conferences would be totally fine if we hadn't had Roy Keane in the middle of it. If it was dull manager, dull player, you'd be like, oh, today was pretty interesting, one of the players said this. But actually, you've been exposed to this
greatness,
supernova, yeah, of interest in the middle of the whole thing, and that kind of skews the rest of the week.
It does a bit. I mean, I still think, I would think these are all very, very boring, even without Roy, but I appreciate your point. It magnifies the intense feeling of... So I've listened to 35 minutes of Jeff Hendrick.
Way to sell these next 3 minutes.
Yeah, I know. Jeff Hendrick, Darren Randolph, Stephen Ward, Cyrus Christie were all before the media. So Jeff Hendrick and Darren Randolph were up first, and we'll just pick it up where it was put to Jeff Hendrick, that Friday night will be the first time he plays against Gareth Bale. He's never played against him before.
No, never. No. First time playing a good few of the players here, but... you know, it's a big game, and I'm just looking forward to playing at home with our crowd.
Lads, what's the mindset entering Friday's game? Considering the other players missing, would you consider a draw at this stage even?
Our mindset's the same. Train hard, prepare for the game and get the result that we need. You know, there's no point in overthinking points or whatever. They have to come here and, you know, it's a must win for them. You know, we're at home. We've played a few away games. We've got a crowd here. There's been big build up and we've just got to make sure we're ready.
Jeff, the last time we had a game of this stature at home was probably the Germany game ahead of Euro 2016. Now that you're playing Premier League every week, and even over the last few weeks playing Liverpool, Arsenal, Chelsea, do you now feel more comfortable at this level? Does it actually make a difference to your game?
Hopefully, yeah. You know, I'm enjoying my time at club level. I'm playing a lot. Like you said, I'm playing against big teams, big players, and you know, it's a good challenge for me every week playing in them sort of games. And it's like I've said for the last few years with Ireland, when I've been playing in these games, it's great to test myself against players like these. And you know, I'm not the type of player who gets nervous going into these games. I look forward to it and try to do my best.
Yeah, and even in the 6-7 months you've had now in the Premier League, I know after the Liverpool game, I think it was Jamie Carragher said you were the best midfielder on the pitch in that game. Do you feel yourself you've grown in confidence a lot, that you're a bit more commanding, a bit more vocal in sessions like this?
Yeah, maybe it took a couple of weeks when I first moved to a new club to get used to it and all, but I really do feel that I've grew as the game's gone on. I feel like my confidence has gone up, and I think I'm better each game. You know, I feel like I'm having a bit... You know, I'm stamping my own soil on games at times, so I just need to continue to do that.
Darren, I think generally if we were playing a team ranked 12th in the world, Ireland would be seen as major underdogs, but because it's Wales, because you know the players so well, that doesn't seem to be the case. Do you feel like that as well, that because you are playing against them every week, you spoke about that familiarity, that there's no real fear there at all of what they offer?
I wouldn't say there's no fear. You can't just brush them off. We'll definitely be aware of the threats they carry. You know, we'll definitely be watching a lot of videos, and we'll have our own game plan. And obviously then look at how they play. And, you know, you saw their achievement in the Euros. You can't just brush them off and think, you know, we're going to just walk all over them. Both sets of players kind of obviously playing in England will be very, very similar, and we all know each other. So, yeah, it's going to be a tough one.
That was Randolph and Hendrick. Randolph was asked at one point, will he...
Randick. And Randolph. It's like a bad 1970s detective series. Randolph and Hendrick. Randick. Go on. Oh, this place stinks of crisps, by the way.
Sorry. So Randolph was asked, can you do any extra work when you're facing... Gareth Bale, the way he kicks the ball, the way he shoots. No, you can't really.
Can you not watch a lot of free kicks on YouTube? You can't you?
Well, he's not. So think about that when Gareth Bale's got a free kick 25 yards out on Friday.
Oh no.
Yeah. Trademark Bale. Randolph didn't see it coming. So Stephen Ward came out then and Cyrus Christie. Ward will obviously start at fullback for us, and we're presuming Seamus Coleman's fine, and he is training fine. But he did arrive on Sunday evening with a bit of a knock, so they're keeping an eye on him. But if things were to go badly for Coleman, then Cyrus Christie would be in at right back. So Stephen Ward first, you know, Wales, Celtic brothers, close proximity. Does this game on Friday have a derby feel, Stephen Ward?
Yeah, I suppose it does. Obviously, you know, a lot of the lads will know each other from playing against each other and you know, playing together at club level. So, you know, it does have a little bit of a derby feel. It's one we're really looking forward to. I'm sure, you know, the atmosphere is going to be electric. And as I say, yeah, you know, roll on Friday now.
What's the build-up been like for you, Cyrus? I know Seamus trained today, but if he didn't start, obviously you'd be in. Are you trying to get your head around whether you're playing or not? Do you feel a bit all over the place with your mentality almost?
No, not at all. I mean, I've come in with a mentality that I could be playing. You know, I didn't know he was injured till obviously we arrived on Sunday. You know, but I've been in this situation before. You know, in plenty of big games where, you know, Seamus is leading up to the game and he's been injured, and you know, I'll just prepare the same way, prepare as if I'm going to play and keep that mentality as if I'm going to be starting. But you know, Seamus has got through it today, which is a big boost for us.
How do you stop Gareth Bale?
Yeah, listen, it's a difficult question. He's obviously, you know, one of the best players in the world. And I think, you know, Roy said it, I think, yesterday about it's very difficult to have a game plan against, you know, these type of people. I think most importantly, we just have to, as an 11 and as a unit, you know, we need to try, you know, not let them have as much time on the ball, get close to them, get tight, and, you know, try and make it uncomfortable for them. But, you know, I'm sure there'll be times in the game where he'll have an effect. It's just we need to hopefully try keep it to a minimum.
Has that been discussed from management in terms of how to handle Bale in the build up to this?
Not yet. I'm sure over the coming days we'll have a chat. But listen, they've got other quality, and you know, obviously he's the main man. But you know, they've got a lot of quality around the pitch. They're a good side. I think they proved in the summer, you know, how good of a side they are. So we're under no illusions how big of a test it is and how tough it's going to be, not only to stop him but to beat a very good Welsh side.
Cyrus, we've obviously spent a lot of time talking about Gareth Bale and the impact he may have. Have you spent much time over the last 2-3 days looking at videos of him and the way he plays and where he plays and how he lines up for Wales and how you'll counter that?
No, I haven't looked at we haven't looked at any videos of him yet. You know, we've looked at the whole team. You know, you can't just prepare for just one man. You know, like we said, there's going to be 11 of them out there. You know, obviously Gareth Bale is their main man, but you know, we have to look at ways to nullify him and nullify the rest of them as well. I mean, if we impose our game plan on them and our style of play and the players that we've got, you know, there's no reason why that we aren't going to come out on top. And you know, like Wardy's touched on it as well, you know, we just have to nullify Bale, and he is going to have moments in the game where he's going to be able to create something, but it's limiting them kind of chances that he's going to have to do that. And you know, we've got to stop the rest of them as well.
An absolute thunder bastard from Lukas Podolski on the occasion of his 130th and final cap for Germany tonight, and Dortmund has them 1-0 up.
Yeah, beautiful left footed top right corner, Joe Hart no chance. And place goes wild. He made a rather long speech before kickoff.
Yeah,
Podolski.
Never seen that before.
No,
he's obviously much more beloved than
we realized.
Would have assumed.
Yeah,
he kind of got what like Dricko and Robbie Keane got.
Yeah, he got a big send off. I mean, German players do. I have seen them make speeches before their final game before.
Yeah,
happened in the last year or two. And then I said there was a raft of columns about how, you know, an English player would never be able to stand with a microphone and speak, and it's just another example of how the Germans are better people than us.
Yeah.
And better, you know, their footballers.
Self-loathing around English football, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And do you think it's only the middle-class educated journalists who write that stuff as opposed to the players? Because is there a little bit of snobbery going on? Oh, look at those players. They're better. I always feel a little bit of the English commentariat around the football team is, well, I mean, if only they'd gone to private school.
Yeah.
Public school, really. But
they're underdeveloped people, yeah. Is the general tone. So that was Ward and Christie. They're all to a man saying we haven't actually talked about how to handle Gareth Bale in any depth. Even Roy yesterday was asked in the press conference, is there a plan to stop Bale? And he sort of said, that's up to the players.
Yeah.
I thought, well, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Maybe get together, have a chat about it before Friday.
He did say, though, look, we'll just make sure that whoever's close to him doesn't. Yeah. In the written thing, he seems to have gone into a little bit more detail.
Hit him.
Make sure he doesn't get turned. Don't allow him to get his head up and get running at you, because obviously that's going to be a situation.
Yeah.
So make sure you get tied to him pretty quickly.
They've like, all certainly seemed to say there'll be no man-marking job.
Like, yeah,
they're not going to let Glenn Whelan follow him around.
And if you're not going to do a man-marking job, then like beyond that, it is just up to, you know, it's a zonal situation. If Gareth Bale is near you, make sure that you don't take your eyes off him.
Yeah, get tied, talk to each other, all that stuff, I suppose. So Chris Coleman was speaking to the media yesterday then, and he was in really good form, really interesting. And I didn't realise the extent to... I didn't realise his Irish roots.
I was looking at his uncle's art. I went and Googled it. He's an artist in Temple Bar who apparently... I don't know if you know Aidan Dunn, if you're familiar with his work. No. He's the very highfalutin art critic of the Irish Times. I was reading some of his work.
Right.
Apparently, Michael Coleman is an absolute sensation.
Okay. Well, Chris Coleman's father, Paddy, lived in Ireland until he was 20 and then moved over to Swansea. So Chris,
East Wall.
Yeah, Chris Cullen was talking about that yesterday.
But yeah, my dad, obviously, was born and bred in Dublin. Dublin boy, he moved to Swansea, I think, when he was 20. It could have gone either way there, but I was born in Swansea. I was never going to... My mother's side of the family, my mother's father's American, so I had an opportunity there as well. But born in Swansea, born in Wales... I was never there.
And you're burying your Irish roots for the next few weeks.
What Irish roots?
And he expanded on all this in the written section then, so people may have read it in the papers today. So Coleman scattered the ashes of his father in Dublin 3 years ago, and he brought them along with a pint of Guinness. So he was born and bred in Dublin before he went to Swansea, age 20. Paddy had requested the ashes be sprinkled into the River Liffey in this manner. And he said, we did it outside the Brazen Head pub next to the River Liffey, which is the oldest pub in Dublin. It dates back to 1198. The history is incredible. I thought it was poignant. I used to take him back most summers for a few days. He'd have a little roam around where he was brought up. He always said, make sure you do it there. It was his request. The Guinness into the Liffey is a done thing there, especially where he's from. I didn't know that.
I've never heard of him.
No.
It's like,
no one in the office had.
It's like that music they put under the Trump video on Paddy's Day.
You throw a pint of Guinness into the Liffey. If I'm honest with you, I did have a little drop first. It was €8 a pint. Not 3 years ago in the recession. Where was he
not
doing that?
Not the Brazen Head, surely.
And he said, Paddy died at the age of 74. 2 years before the tournament, Coleman said in France how he dearly wished his father would have seen the success, having watched his son toil in previous years. Unfortunately for him, it was going wrong for me at Wales, so he never got to see us at the tournament. I was very close to him. He lived in Swansea for 50 years, still had his Dublin accent, never changed a bit. So I never knew that about Chris Coleman. There you go.
Taxi driver one time telling me about the dad from the East Wall, but apparently the East Wall is a hotbed. I think is Liam Toohey from the East Wall as well? I think they would have
not
been
sure.
Vaguely contemporaneous. Maybe some of the texts in 53106 is the number. John Hartson's been talking the smack talk in our general direction. Mm-hmm. Every time he's come on the show, basically ever since Wales got good at international football, it's been like, well, we're good. Your lot were no good at the Euros, were you? We're about to find out on Friday what the truth is. He's up next alongside Kenny Cunningham.
Off the ball.
Get all the best bits at newstalk.com/off the ball.
Newstalk 106 to 108.
53106 is the text number. If you want to get in touch with us, you can tweet the show at Off the Ball. Germany are bringing on Thomas Müller to run things aground for the final 15 minutes of the game tonight. They're 1-0 up against England. Lukas Podolski with an absolute stunner right in the side netting from about, maybe not quite 30 yards, but definitely 25. The precise goal that Lukas Podolski would have designed if you could have asked him, what do you want to do to finish your last game? Kind of like the Liam Brady final game for West Ham, where he comes off the bench and scores a really chippy goal. It's like, it's absolutely perfect.
Yeah. Kenny Cunningham, what did you do in your last game?
I limped off the pitch practically at half time. I'd rip my knee ligament. Sorry, lads. Sorry to bring the town down a bit, but it's all a bit pathetic. Yeah, that was
fitting.
No glory there, I'm afraid. Just head down, limping off, thinking.
Oh, no.
That's it.
I didn't know that when I asked, actually. That's tough.
Yeah.
Who was that for?
Sunderland. Was
it? It was actually Sunderland, yeah. I got myself back fit, to be honest with you, but I don't think I actually played a competitive game after that, so that's the other side of the story, lads. Yeah, it's not all about the glory.
No. Did you see, are you watching any of Germany-England?
Yeah, I have been watching, actually. I just saw that Podolski goal. Jared was 26.5.
There you go.
Yeah, the actual shot, just to be precise.
Not bad.
And that was brilliant. He had about four or five shots. It was basically shoot on goal every time he got the ball on that left foot all evening. And that one he really caught hold of, flew into the top corner. But England done quite well up to then, actually. Hadn't played too badly. Been unfortunate to be behind, but the biggest speech I've ever seen prior to a football game.
Yeah, we were talking about that. What happened?
Oh my God, ridiculous.
Was it all in German or was there any of it in English? So
I switched off, to be honest, because it was so funny. Just when the camera went in close to him, you could see all the English players stood behind and some of the faces they were pulling was absolutely comical, thinking, what is going on here?
Yeah.
Let's just get the game on.
Speaking of getting the game on, John Hartson is not playing the game with us at the moment. He's not answering, even though he's been very excited all day about the fact that he was going to come on and lord it over. So.
You know what? I'm not surprised yet. We're sick of the sight of each other. You must have told him I was actually coming on the show.
He was excited.
Me and John do obviously a bit of work with the Europa League in Dublin. We are literally sick of the sight of each other over the past couple of weeks. So it doesn't surprise me at all. He's run for the hills. We've nothing to say to each other, lads. Literally boring each other to death. The conversation's run dry. He's done us both a favour not coming on tonight.
Are you confident about Friday?
No, I'm not. I'm sure you mean confident of a win.
Yeah.
I'm not actually confident of a win now for a couple of reasons. Obviously, we've lost a few players through injury, possibly three or four of our starting 11. Wales come to Dublin full strength, but it's more so the kind of psychological aspect from Wales' point of view, I think, in terms of where they are in the group. And although they're not talking about a must-win game, lads, you sense that's the case. That'll be the mindset of the players. And although we certainly won't be going out for a draw, anything but a win, I just feel the mentality will be slightly different amongst both sets of players. And they'll feel as if, particularly the Serbia game kicks off a bit early, lads, and it's a 5 o'clock kickoff. I think the Serbia-Georgia game, they could well be top of the table with 11 points by the time we actually kick off. And then it puts even more pressure on Wales prior to the kickoff. So, yeah, for those kind of reasons, put all those reasons together, I just feel as if it's a game I wouldn't be confident of winning. And my gut feeling tells me, I'll wait till I see the team before kickoff, but my kind of gut feeling tells me Wales will probably take something from the game, a draw if not the win.
Yeah, so from an Irish perspective, right, knowing that Wales feel that this is a must-win game, and Robbie Savoy said that in the show last night, from their perspective that, you know, if they're going to get back in after some of the bad results they've had, what Roy Keane said, you know, you must be much mistaken.
Yeah.
If you think that we're going to be going in looking for anything other than a win. And I know everybody says that, but you start having those injuries and you realise that a draw would actually be a decent result with the other games that we have still to come. It's hard not to have that mindset that we'll be what we have, we hold from the get-go.
Yeah, I don't think it will. I don't think it'll be it's more of a subconscious thing, lads, I think, at the back of your mind. I don't think that'll be the foremost of our players' minds are. When the game starts, Martin will set out the team. We'll understand their shape. We'll know how they're going to play, and that won't be easy. The way Wales set up, that kind of, I'd imagine it'll be that kind of 3-4-3 system. With probably Bale and Ramsey playing in those kind of pockets just off the main striker, pretty similar to Chelsea, where they've been playing it quite some time. It's their preferred formation. It suits them very well. The balance of the team is good. It gets Bale and Ramsey into those areas of the pitch where they want them, in those little pockets in front of their back four. So, you know, I think from our point of view, the mindset's got to be, from a tactical point of view, you know, how we deal with that. We need to be aware of that. You know, they can't take us by surprise early in the game. They start working those little clever combinations and triangles and getting balls into their feet. We need to be ready for it.
So what do you do? So if you were picking a team to set up against that, what do you do?
Well, it just means, I think, potentially, like, obviously Martin's thrown in a few different variations in terms of formation and kind of shape. He's gone with a kind of a diamond midfield at times, kind of two up front. But I think against this Welsh team, for me, you really got to overload that central area of the pitch. I'd be surprised if Martin, if we don't see an orthodox 4-3-3 with three orthodox centre midfielders in there, if you know what I mean. I'm not talking about a number 10 and a midfield partnership tucked in behind. I'm talking about three orthodox centre midfield players with kind of good legs, you know, physically imposing, whether it's Glenn, James McCarthy, David Moyle in particular, done great for us when he came out against Austria. Conor Hourihan, there's a few in there who he can lean to. And then obviously your front three, you got the likes of maybe Jet McLean and Walter supplementing that, dropping into a five when we need it. But we need to get bodies into those central areas, because Bale and Rams are going to drift in there. And if they can get the ball in on the half turn and get turned and get running at us, we're really in trouble. So for me, although we've gone with a few different formations for this game in particular, with the strength Wales have in those kind of central areas. We really need to reinforce that central area of the pitch. It's going to be key. So I could well be wrong, but that's kind of how I see it.
In your experience at this level, will there be detailed conversations about how we're handling Gareth Bale? Because the players all have been asked about this today and they've all sort of said, ah, look, it doesn't really work like that. You know, we'll chat to each other on the pitch. It's not like he's going to be man-marked. You know, we'll pass him off. We'll try and get tight to him. But there's going to be no set plan. Is that the reality behind the scenes in your experience when you're coming up against a player of Bale's stature?
Yeah, it is, of course. Yeah, we don't see man-to-man nowadays. I'm actually surprised you don't see a little bit more of it, to be honest with you. But no, it will be the case of getting bodies around them, denying them, that was almost suffocating them, you know, wherever areas of the pitch where he goes to get the ball. But for me, it's about how we deal with the Welsh system, not Gareth Bale. If we don't deal with the Welsh system in terms of how they play, kind of how high up the pitch we press them, when we go to press, who presses, where we look to show them, if we get those things wrong, for me, there's a ripple effect of that. Gareth Bale will invariably get the ball in good areas of the pitch and areas of the pitch where we don't want him to get it. So for me, it's about what we do a little bit higher up the pitch when their back three splits, their wing backs get high up the pitch in terms of how we confront that. I mean, do we take a conservative approach and ask our wingers to kind of drop with their wing backs as far down the pitch as possible to the extent where we end up with a back six? Or do we get a little bit braver at times and keep one of our wingers higher up the pitch on one of their wide centre halves and push one of our full backs out of position, out of that defensive unit, a bit higher up the pitch on their wing backs and actually go and engage them a little bit higher up the pitch? It might leave yourself a little bit open in behind, maybe for the likes of Bale and Ramsey to drive into those areas in behind fullback. So it's those type of things, those decisions which we make a little bit higher up the pitch actually before Bale gets the ball, which for me is going to have a big bearing on the game.
Kev was on last night, obviously. He thinks it'll be more conservative, that we'll be deep for a lot of the match, that we won't actually have as much of the ball as Irish fans might hope we have, and we just use that pace that we have to try and hit them at times.
Yeah, that might well be the case. I mean, I'm looking at, I was thinking maybe a front three. I always think maybe Shane Long, Jonathan Walters to the right and James McLean to the left. And that's a pretty impressive front three for me in terms of physicality, dynamism, particularly in the case of James, obviously, and Shane Long. Yeah, so to an extent, I can understand the fact, maybe not a conscious decision to drop back deep. We may get pushed back there, but we might be comfortable at times maybe to drop into those deeper positions, knowing that Shane's got the ability maybe to spin off the shoulder like Chester and Ben Davies, I'd imagine, in those kind of wide central positions for Wales. You know, maybe hit them on the counter-attack a little bit, James to join in, use his pace to join in from deeper positions than one of the central midfield players. So it may work out that way. We very rarely dominate possession, lads, anyway. Yeah. But by and large, we're generally forced back into those areas of the pitch. So that may well be the case. But, you know, it might suit us at times. But I wouldn't like to see us camped on our 18-yard box, lads, for kind of long periods. Because, like I said, if the likes of Ramsey and Bale in particular, even Joe Allen, who play a slightly deeper position in midfield, they get enough possession, enough territory in their half the pitch with their heads up. You know, you'd like to think, you'd imagine sooner or later you're going to see that little bit of quality, a little bit of combination one-touch play, or a bit of individual quality that's going to open us up. So I'd actually like to see us get a little bit braver, because I think if we get enough possession in their last third of the pitch and get any type of good crosses into the box, and we can against this system, if there is kind of one weakness in this system that Wales play 3-4-3 with the front lads narrow, it means we can get our fullbacks high up the pitch 2v1 with our wingers down the sides and kind of double up on their wingbacks. And if we get good delivery into the box, we've got an edge on them. The head and power of Walters, James McLean attacking the back post, Shane's aerial ability as well. I think we have the edge on their back three. Chester's no joint, either is Ben Davies in that kind of left central defensive position. So I'd like to see us get on the front foot and get enough bit of sustained pressure in their last third of the pitch. We get good quality delivery into the box, so I think we can open them up.
Just so, if McCarthy is not fit to play, that midfield trio would be Whelan, Hendrick and Myler for you?
Yeah, I'd be absolutely fine with that. I mean, Conor Hourihan, I think, is making a strong case for inclusion as well. But that's the kind of prototype I'm looking at. You know, real three, defensively solid, disciplined players in that area of the pitch. Jeff can obviously break off. He's very comfortable breaking off in the forward area. David Morley can do it. He's got the legs to do as well on occasion. But when we drop into that defensive shape and they're checking their shoulders, if Joe Allen drops and gets the ball off their back three and starts walking into our half the pitch and he's looking to pop little 10-15 yard angle passes into the feet of Bale and Ramsey off the front, they're the type of players you want in there. Glenn Whelan, his experience, sense and danger. David Moyler as well. That kind of defensive mindset, checking their shoulders, cutting those passing lanes into the feet of Bale and Ramsey. And obviously our back four being brave enough to keep as high a starting position as well, just to really squeeze those spaces in front of our back four.
One last thing, Coleman was saying that they're feeling very confident because this is the first time since the semi-final of the Euros that he's had his three best players available to him at the same time, and that's one of the reasons why they've stuttered so far in the qualifying group. Like, the lead that we have in the qualifying group is very tenuous. It's that we have a 2-point lead after four games, but over the next bunch of games all the top teams really play each other, and so even Austria, who are at the moment are 6 points out of it, if we stutter against Wales in this game, they'll be coming to Dublin thinking, win this game, and they're right back in it. So, like,
no doubt.
You know, there's a reward if we are aggressive and go and try and win this game as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. You're absolutely right. You look at the table and you think, oh, we're in such a great position. Of course we are. We've had a great start, but I agree with you. I think it can change so quickly. You know, Serbia go and win in Georgia as we expect. You know, maybe Wales get the better of us in a very close encounter. You know what I mean? And all of a sudden, we're back into second place in the group. And, you know, Wales breathing down our necks. We've still got to go to Cardiff last game of the group. So that's how quickly you're right. It can change. And you mentioned about kind of key players. I mean, whether Coleman goes, he speaks about having all his players available.
Yeah.
But his decision whether to go with maybe Vogster or Robson Cannon will front, for me, it'll be interesting. Without Shane Duffy in there, I just wonder whether he'd be tempted to throw Sam Vokes up there, who's a monster physically, a great header of the ball. And Shane Duffy is one of his great strengths, of course. He dominates everybody in the air. So, you know, Robson Cannon, a different type of player, more mobile, looks to attack the grass in behind. So it'll be interesting to see which way Coleman jumps there in terms of his team selection. But he's right, he must be relatively confident, but I wouldn't get too carried away with it in terms of being overly confident. Yeah. They're coming onto the pitch knowing that anything but a win puts them in real jeopardy of not making these one of the top two places. So real pressure on his team as well. I don't think they've played under these conditions for quite some time in terms of the real pressure they're under. I know the Euros during the summer, there's a certain amount of pressure, but you know, once they qualified for knockout stages, they couldn't lose, really, you know what I mean? But this is real. This is, for me, is real pressure on their shoulders going into the game.
Good stuff, Kenny.
Cheers, Kenny.
Cheers, lads.
Talk to you again soon. How are you, Tom?
Very, very struck last night and tonight coming in listening to the show, how all the players and Roy Keane all saying, let's not watch any videos.
Or, no.
You know, let's not have a game plan.
Let's not do preparation.
It's right very there. Worrying, isn't it?
it's certainly striking. Yeah. That's the O'Neill approach, though.
Well, I heard him talk recently. Like, he's been obsessing about the game. Keane says he hasn't, but O'Neill says he has, and he's only going to give the players a certain amount of information.
Sure.
That's what he says.
Yeah, he just doesn't give it to them.
Kind of like the Ken Loach approach to filmmaking.
Yes.
Just, you know, okay, they'll find it in the night.
Yeah.
That's grand.
It worked out pretty well for Ken Loach.
Yeah, it has,
If I had a career, like a pittance of what he had.
Oscar nom this year and everything, I've loads of great stuff going around at the moment. Hooray for the Riff Raff. It's an absolutely brilliant album. I think the Depeche Mode album is brilliant. New album from Spoon is wonderful too. Samantha Crane, due on these shores very soon. I think she's a very talented lady. And mixed in with all of that, going to be trying to predict the Electric Picnic lineup, which is coming tomorrow. Sometime, I think, late afternoon. You're probably going to get a smattering of it tomorrow. You won't get the real bands. But I think of this thing, it sells out so easily. They don't need to say it's on.
Yeah.
I think you need to keep pressure on them to produce really amazing bands.
I've heard you. I've been listening to my Spotify ads and it's you telling me what's going to be on.
Yeah, I don't name any bands, do I?
No, you do.
I name areas.
Yeah.
I tell you where the areas are. Body and soul.
It's great,
stuff like that. Yeah,
and they've got a lot of areas.
Or they'll sell out. But just if they sell out, does it put them in a situation where they only need to book, you know, a crap band? Yes,
you can't say that. You might.
Has the quality been going down?
I don't think it has, but you really wonder.
Right.
How long can it continue?
All right, good stuff. I knew Paddy Coleman very well, an absolute gentleman. Every time I was in Swansea for a Munster game, we'd meet up for a couple of pints and chat about old times in Ireland. He loved talking about Dublin, and yes, he never lost his accent. R.I.P. Paddy, says Declan from Limerick.
That's great.
We've got Tomo up next.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
All right, you're very welcome back. 53106 is the text number here. If you want to get in touch with us, you can tweet the show at Off the Ball as well. Now, we're going back to the main football story of the day, which is obviously the passing of Ronnie Moran, a Liverpool legend. And I'm delighted to say we've got another Liverpool legend, Phil Thompson, on the line. Phil, good evening to you.
Good evening, mate. How are you?
I guess when you live a life as full and varied as Ronnie Moran's, you hope anyway that ultimately his passing is an opportunity for people to celebrate and share memories. And we had Graeme Souness on the show a little bit earlier on, and he had some great stories about what life was like under Ronnie Moran. What's your abiding memory of him?
Listen, my time goes back more than most. I don't know how many people you've had on, and everybody should pay tribute to the great man. But when I first joined Liverpool in 1969 as an apprentice, Ronnie was my coach. He was in the B team. That was my first team when I started off. And lo and behold, our paths went right the way through him as a coach, me as a player. I went through B team, A team, reserve team, and then the first team. He was an absolutely terrific guy. He could be really hard. And in those early days, you just think there's nothing ever satisfied this man. Could win 4-0 on a Saturday, 5-0. Monday morning, he'd be bellowing instructions, give it in, what are you? He'd be moaning like a drain. But that's what was needed at that particular time. Certainly when that team was becoming the best team in Europe, if not the best team in the world.
Did you model yourself on him for a while when you ended up in a fairly similar role in the backroom team?
I do believe I did. Because you had to be tough and you had to be thick-skinned to play under Ronnie Moran. In the first team, he'd be bellowing out instructions from the touchline. And it was a tough school. So when I became reserve team coach in 1986 under Kenny Dalglish and became part of the boot room, it was a wonderful moment. And I did most of my stuff what I did, because it was only me. With the reserves, I'd done all the coaching, all the preparation, all the travel. I did everything. And I modelled myself on him. And then, lo and behold, many years later, when I had the opportunity to come back in 1998 as assistant to Gerard Houllier, I had to warn Gerard. I said, you'll be up against something completely different than you've ever worked with. I said, I can be. And I'd been brought in to be Mr. Angry, Mr. And that suited me from what I'd been. But it's been all what I'd been taught from Ronnie Moran, is to make people for the good of the team, knowing, drumming into them, good habits, pass to the nearest red shirt, pass and move. And that's the way it had to be. And if you didn't, and you couldn't hack it, and I'd learned that as a kid, well, you got moved on.
Looking at his career, Phil, we talked to Graeme Souness really, you know, about the 80s in particular, late 70s, 80s, and you had that interesting insight into Ronnie Moran when he's a youth team coach from 68 on. And I guess he's transitioning into what would become the greater part of his career. Did he change much, or was he fairly similar from day one?
He was fairly similar from day one. You know, as a coach in the early days, you didn't get much help. Excuse me. It was just you with your team, the B team or the A team or the reserve team, and you were coached. But as Ronnie became first with the first team in 1974, excuse me, I was 20 years of age. You could see him develop, and he took on that, because you had Bob Paisley then, because Shanks had just retired, who found it very difficult. Bob was a genius, but found it difficult to communicate. But you had then Joe Fagan, who was a very quiet man. You know, Joe didn't often raise his voice. When he did, you listened. So it was down to Ronnie, day after day, doing all the training. Ronnie was a physio. Ronnie was the administration officer. He would take your orders for pre-match meals. He would book the rooms into double rooms, me with Terry McDermott, everything to get done. He would do all the kit. And you were just absolutely, he did all these jobs. And they said, be doing their physiotherapy besides that. But where, and I don't think he got as much credit, was him as a coach. Because our training may have only been five sides, but it was always seven or eight sides across half a pitch. It was all appertaining to a match day situation. One touch, two touch, pass and move, making forward runs. And it would be like if we didn't have enough forward runs of a Saturday, it would be designed on a Monday morning. You'd have to pass a ball and you'd have to run forward 10 yards without. It doesn't matter where you were on the pitch.
I heard as well that he liked to stop the training sessions and give instruction in the middle of it.
Oh, quite often. He'd be asking us why you done that. So although we didn't coach in a full-sided game on a full pitch, this happened. But he would stop and he would moan. And that's what I'm saying. It was all repetition. Repetition until you knew the Liverpool way. And as a lot of guys who probably may have said, they found it very difficult to break in the first year that they came in. They had to go in the reserves.
Phil, when you're talking to players from other teams, are they doing the same thing? Is it that you guys had the best coaching or good coaching, but you had the best players? Like, because just trying to understand why this is the dominant team of their generation in world football. And here's this guy at the middle of it and he's the coach, and like ultimately the manager sets the agenda, builds the team shape, but the coach has to implement it. So is it that the players were so good that he was working with, or actually he's doing something slightly different from what everybody else is doing as well?
Listen, it's always about good players and good identification. You would be at Liverpool and you would notice as you were getting a little bit older, or maybe it wasn't working for you, the identification would come from Bob Paisley or Joe or Ronnie. And they would see, it's like a massive jigsaw puzzle, and a piece in the middle is becoming rough around the edges. Well, you take that out and you find an exact replica to go back in that place. Well, that was the same as what we had as a football pitch. They would look for like to be bringing, but you had to have the drive and desire to be a Liverpool player, not just to do it once every five games. This had to be 4 out of 5 games, 9 out of 10 games. You had to be of a 9 out of 10. So this is what the requirement. So it was good players, but you had to be coached, and coached in a way that when we were winning everything, we were dominating Europe, probably world football, you needed somebody to keep your feet on the ground as much as any of the coaching that you did. And Ronnie was that man. He was your go-to man all the time. And as I say, we all thought he was the biggest moaner in the world. But when you got to 27, 28, you realised what this man was all about. His coaching techniques, but his drive kept your feet on the ground to make sure you prepared for the next game. You forgot about the last one and you drove to win the next match and the match after that. It was an incredible... It was wonderful. I don't mind admitting, and he launched his book a couple of weeks ago, and I was at the launch in the Liverpool souvenir shop in Liverpool Town Centre, and I was delighted the family asked me to do with the foreword on it. And I'd have been quite angry, to be honest, if they'd have asked somebody else, because Ronnie and myself went right the way through the club together, and I feel part of his life, he probably felt part of mine. And I felt privileged to have something to do with it, and I hosted the evening at the supporters' club, and I can't believe a couple of weeks later, Ronnie has died. God bless him.
Like, you make a point in your foreword that when you were a kid, you used to write out all the names of the Liverpool players in coal on the walls of the coal shed at your mum's house in Kirkby. And obviously other players would move on and a young Phil Thompson would rub out their names, but you never had to rub out more. And his longevity is just something special. You know, across the 90s, and we had Souness on talking about this earlier, and like Moran, obviously... loved the old school Liverpool way, stopping the five-a-sides, just, you know, the boot room stuff. Was he wrongly or otherwise ever perceived at Liverpool as being old school, out of touch in those later years, or how did he fit into that as the game was changing so much, Phil?
Well, it was difficult, and the game was changing a little bit. The money was sort of becoming bigger. We had the Spice Boy era. That was coming along, which was difficult times for Ronnie to accept. And yes, he might have been. Don't forget, all what we were doing in those small-sided games, the pass and move, the Liverpool way, nearest red jersey, making these long bursting runs, McDermott, Case, Ray Kennedy. Sir Alex Ferguson did exactly the same at Manchester United. You ask a lot of their players and what they did. Most of their things were from what Liverpool Football Club did. Mm. But yes, I would probably have to admit it was hard for Ronnie to get his head around the way the game was changing. And my goodness, we even went and got a physiotherapy. a physio actually came in, which really threw a spanner in the works. Mm. Mind you, it was only of an afternoon.
Yeah. And did you find that difficult? Did you find that odd and think, oh, this is getting a bit crazy now?
I was a little bit younger than Ronnie. So when I came back into Liverpool in 1998 with Gerard Houllier, and Roy Evans had just moved on, and Roy was probably one of the last of the boot room boys. I sort of take on these guys. And in the early days, people were sort of, as soon as I came through the door, people were warning me, you know, you can't discipline these lads. These are millionaires.
Yeah.
You can't do it. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but millionaires can't be taught discipline and taught good habits. Well, I'm sorry. I says, I'll have a fight with that. And probably I made too good a fight of it. Because that's the reason that I was brought in. And all those habits was something that Ronnie Moran, so I was maybe a younger Ronnie Moran, which a little bit more change about me. So I was a little bit more open to things. And I think maybe that's why it worked.
Mm. One last point. It strikes me, you know, the five-a-sides stopping it and pointing out patterns or things which are wrong. And, you know, the way that Moran did it, maybe at the peak of his powers, like that really should never go out of fashion. That's kind of how you play football still.
Oh, absolutely. You know, people have pretty patterns now. People have, they have all kinds of technical staff to look on computers of playing little pretty pictures with them and how far play. This wasn't Ronnie Moran. You know, Ronnie Moran, it was eyes and ears listening to people. What you see on a football pitch, his eyes told him whether somebody was tired or not. And he would, maybe it's like Kenny Dalglish in his later years. They gave Kenny like 3 days off. Now, that wasn't rocket science. That's, yeah. As to what was best for that person to perform better on a Saturday. And Ronnie Moran and Joe Fagan and Bob Paisley, even Kenny allowed these guys to still do the training when he took over. He knew how clever they were when Kenny took over the mantle from Joe Fagan. And he didn't want to change much because he knew it worked.
Yeah.
And when if it works, if something's not broken, you don't change it.
Phil, it's been great having you on. I'm sorry for your loss. Thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Phil Thompson, Liverpool legend there, talking about another Liverpool legend, Ronnie Moran. Now, earlier we asked you to identify our mystery voice. It was, of course...
There's more that goes into it than that.
Rory McIlroy. So congratulations to Dara O'Connor. You're into the draw, Dara, to win yourself a round of golf at Royal County Down and also Ard Glass in County Down. The winner will also get two nights at the 4-star Burrendale Hotel in Newcastle at the foot of the Mourne Mountains. It's all thanks to Discover Northern Ireland. A great range of stay and play offers are now available on discovernorthernireland.com. We're going to give you another chance to get into that draw on tomorrow night's show. That's all we've got time for tonight. Tom Dunn is up next. Good night.
Good night.
Off the ball.
Get all the best bits at newstalk.com/offtheball.
Newstalk 106 to 108.